1967 to start public high school, and that was sort of also the start of a lot of other changes. So Vietnam was raging at the time. It's hard to relate the impact that that war had on my generation. Certainly shaped my worldview in many ways, you know, one that among other things. 1968 was a pivotal year. It was the year of the election at the time. It was the year that Martin Luther King was assassinated, the year that Robert Kennedy was assassinated. There were riots throughout the U.S. in many of the African-American neighborhoods. Where I live now in the district, it was actually mostly destroyed that summer. The Chicago Democratic Convention was a very influential. I, you know, watched it on TV, a black and white TV that we I had, and it was quite striking to watch the demonstrators get beat up by the police. So anyway, that was the course I took in the late 60s during high school, particularly my last year in high school. I started the University of Miami as a history major. That was my love. I had been a big fan of history from high school and a voracious reader of that topic. Just my eyes opened up with East Asian history, mostly China, well, and also South Asian, India, with dynamic professors, took Latin American history, but eventually rerouted to science and pre-med, what would now be called pre-med, in part because I did some moving around, I traveled, I tried to reconnect with Latin America as part of a political process. I evolved from my childhood upbringing of, you know, everything in Cuba is bad and the Cuban Revolution was horrible, to re-evaluating that. And then that led me to reconnect with Latin America. So I moved to Puerto Rico for 6 months to live. I was trying to relearn Spanish. When I was a first year college student, I couldn't carry on an adult conversation fully in Spanish. I spoke with my friends who were Cuban and mixed all the time using both languages. I pushed myself to read literature primarily, and that way I reconnected with Spanish. It was a long process because, you know, of course, patience later made me connect with Spanish too. I refocused on medicine starting in 1973 when I left Puerto Rico and went back to University of Miami to sort of say, okay, I'm going to become a doctor. And my idea at the time was, well, if I'm a physician, I can have a job and then do other things. That was the delusion I had. My father was a role model for me as a physician, and we connected extensively on this basis, both as a just a casual conversations. For a while, he would take me to medical school. In the first couple of years, he'd pick me up. I had one car. So my partner was keeping our car. My class was 150 students. There were 17 Latinos, 8 women, which is amazing nowadays. Of course, that's changed. And 4 African Americans at the University of Miami. And the other reason there were so many Latinos that year was because my father had actually been on the selection committee, so they had admitted more than ever. It eventually went back up, but it went down initially. I really connected with patient care. I had zero research experience in medical school, zero exposure to any of the research I subsequently did, and zero actual exposure to primary care, to be honest. I never did a rotation in the outpatient clinic. They didn't have them back then. But I applied to and was accepted to the General Internal Medicine Primary Care Program at UC San Francisco. And I connected to it, and it quickly became and continues to be a passion. So the West is the best, from an old Doors song. Once I arrived in California, I had a different perspective on biculturalism, on Latinos. In Miami, Latinos had continued to have a significant economic power, even though there are disparities in quite a lot of the spectrum. In San Francisco, it was clear that the Latinos were at the lower end of the ladder, professionally as well as in the community, compared to even African Americans there, where there were more African Americans present in the professional ranks. But I focused on internal medicine. I did a research fellowship that opened my eyes and about research. It was really when I applied to and got accepted to the fellowship, it was more like, well, I don't really know what I want to do, so this opportunity was there. I didn't really want to be a specialist, which is what people did fellowships for. I never did lab science. I really didn't know what population science was about. We just were doing clinical research. We're just learning methods as a third-year resident. And in my fellowship, I had the opportunity to have exposure and teaching and seminars with both senior fellows and professors who were just great at teaching clinical epidemiology. And it's basic research methods, understanding research design, understanding the importance of precise measurement, validity, reliability, all the things that people now take for granted that they have to learn or learn. We were just discovering that, and of course, there were no computers. We were just reading books and go to the library, and I'd spend lots of time in the library pulling articles and reading books. That's the way it was back then. I was interested in cultural factors and communication with Latinos. That was my instinct of what I wanted to do. I was interested in the concept of acculturation. I read enough that I knew I couldn't do the work to actually do the things I wanted to do with it, because I didn't have either the skill set or the resources or knew enough about the methods to be able to do it. Went through a variety of processes to land the faculty position. I should also mention the HIV epidemic, because much like it's happening now with COVID, and it's shaping all of our lives and all of your careers, HIV really shaped our times then. First cases in San Francisco were in June of 1981. I was a medical resident on the wards. We had a patient with advanced interstitial lung disease in an intensive care unit, not diagnosed with pneumocystis, but he died from that disease. And then the report came out in MWR from Los Angeles during the time that patient was hospitalized. And over the course of the next 2 years, San Francisco was one of the epicenters. It was very political. It was focused on the gay community. The gay male community, I should say. There were a lot of controversy on a variety of factors, and it's time for other stories there, perhaps. But as a faculty member, I started working with behavioral and population scientists. I applied for and got an R01 as a principal investigator, and then, which mostly I wrote part of it, but it was heavily written by two social scientists, collaborators. I did write a grant to NHLBI, actually, that also got funded, but I wasn't the PI. It was a clinical trial of an intervention for what we used to call mild hypertension. And I really began to try and develop minority health issues, because the R01 I did get as PI was the tobacco with smoking cessation grant from NCI. I began partnering with other minority scientists that was able to spend those early years of my assistant professorship as a sort of, I don't want to say in isolation, but protected. So I didn't have 20 people asking me to do stuff, and my chief was very good about giving me advice. I remember I had one meeting with him early on, a couple years into my faculty, where he looked at what I had done so far with my CV and what I had published, and he goes, oh, you're getting papers out. They're in journals I never heard of, but you're getting work out. At the same time, he kept me from getting named to the medical school admissions committee, which was a major time commitment. Although, as soon as I became associate professor, I got a phone call to do that, which was fine. in I partnered with another minority faculty in the early 90s to form a minority research center at UCSF. And then later in the mid-90s, we got an NIA, a National Institute on Aging grant, the Resource Center for Minority Aging, which is still going at UCSF. When I left, I passed it on to Anna Annapolis, who's now the scientific director at NMHD. So she wrote the renewal, and it's the principal investigator now is Leah Carling. So the issue of diversity in medicine and science became emerging. And I'll just, one word of advice before, is learn about the value of saying yes. You know, all the senior people telling junior people, say, gotta learn to say no, gotta learn to say no. And there is value in that, but don't forget about saying yes. If I hadn't said yes to Barbara Marin when she came to me and said, you know, I've got this, you know, she was a fellow, she wanted to get a grant so she could stay on and research. And we figured out that if I was the PI, we could do it because I was already faculty. In UCSF, you had to be faculty to apply for a grant. And that partnership was very productive. When Gene Washington was developing the plans for a research center on minority health, you know, that was another factor. So I think that that really changed my career trajectory events, which I could not have predicted. Oh yeah, this is going to be a win-win situation. And so I do want to have everyone think about that. So why come to NIMHD? So now this is 5 years ago already that I came, although the opportunity became open in the summer or the spring of 2014. At the time I was on the National Advisory Council of the National Institute on Aging. So I had learned over the course of the 4 years I was on the council, how NIH really worked on the inside. As a PI and reviewer, I never really got that sense. I wasn't one to call up program officers or come to visit or check in. I mean, I did that a few times with other people, but it wasn't my my standard. And I was able to appreciate the leverage and the importance and the excitement of the science here.